CliffCentral.com.
On the Auto Trader podcast.
In the last few months on social media, there has been an increase of electric cars and governments, those two search terms kind of being used by people. As a result of this new theory that governments are kind of colluding to get the petrol price and fuel prices around the world to increase to get more people buying electric vehicles. Why would the government want to do that? The theory there is that they want to be able to control when they turn on and off a car, for instance. So there's a criminal who's driving this car.
And they want to turn it off.
And to turn it off to kind of get rid of them. Type vibe.
Why can't you do that in a...
I think it's a load of bollocks.
But a load of rubbish. And the reason I think that is because...
You can do that in an ICE car, right?
You can do that in an ICE car. You don't need an EV to do that.
Yeah.
Catch us every Monday at 9 a.m. on YouTube and on autotrader.co.za.
Hey, can you imagine if the government had the power to turn off your electric car? I mean, how much corruption is involved in that? Imagine you're like bribing some guy at an office who's sitting in front of a whole bunch of screens. Oh. Please, chief, don't switch off my car. Yeah, I'm going to send you some money. Unreal.
Galuma Eskom. Hey, I'd bite Eskom. Sure.
Well, now let's see how they do. I mean, they've been given a massive loan, and some of it is a grant as well, to convert power stations from coal into other sources like wind and battery, and also develop the electric vehicle market in South Africa. So
I think you can't give government power to switch off people's cars. It just will go very, very badly very quickly. Because it's going to, in this country, I mean, you can't even get them to do the basic stuff that we actually go and vote for them to do. So there's no way they'd be able to do this properly. But we won't get stuck in the reeds on a Monday morning. Yeah. You want to add something, Mash, before we move on?
Yes. This takes me back to the whole thing that happened with Apple and the FBI a couple of years ago, where the FBI wanted access to a deceased terrorist's iPhone.
Right.
And Apple was like, we do not have the technology to access anybody's iPhone. Right. And we do not want to create that technology, because making that technology would actually open a whole new can of worms that we do not want anybody to have access to.
Well,
so if government does this once, it opens a whole new can of worms for even criminals.
The reason that we even brought this up to start the second hour of the show this morning, and if you've just woken up and joined us, hello, good morning, is because Auto Trader, the Auto Trader podcast, brand new episode today, they were talking about this and why there's suddenly such an interest in electric cars and government, and that is why. So don't miss the latest edition of the Auto Trader podcast. But we were also talking just before the break about matric and matric exams. And we were talking about ways that people can cope with stress. And, you know, Leanne was saying that if she just takes a glass of water and just holds it up to her wrists, that tends to help her a little bit with anxiety and that kind of thing. So now everybody's going to do that. But are there any other things? Listen, whatever works for you, right? Any other things that you can think of that we all need to be paying attention to in order to help people who are writing matric exams at the moment? It is stressful, whether or not, you know, Dr. Renan said at the beginning of his discussion, he said, if you value something, there's going to be stress because Because the stress comes from the fact that you hope for a certain result. You're working towards a certain outcome, and therefore you're tied to that outcome. So you have to care about that outcome. And if you care about something, then you're going to get anxious if it doesn't go your way. It makes perfect sense. Maybe there are some people who just don't care about matric exams, and maybe that, you know, that's a problem that we need to discuss in another time. But there are obviously all these stresses of modern living that maybe we didn't have to put up with 10, 15,
for sure,
20 years ago.
I just remember in my matric year, our principal greeted us in a line. She stood at the end of our line and said something personal to each of us before the exams. And when it got to me, she said, "Leanne, we are really expecting big results from you." And that threw me completely. I did not perform as well in my matric exams as I had during the rest of the year because of that. That's no fault of her own. She was being encouraging, but to the point of the types of schools that have been set up now to help people with this performance anxiety and that sort of thing, there wasn't a support system for that before. And those schools will know that sometimes that sort of laying that expectation on someone can be more harmful than good.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because it's a personal story, and I don't, you know, some people would respond very well to that. They'd go, "Oh, well, that's encouragement because now,
I like
a bit of a responsibility. I like to shoulder a burden. I like being relied upon to deliver." But then there are other people who it can cripple them completely. They just they want to run the opposite direction. As soon as you expect things from them, they go, "Don't do it," you know,
malfunction.
How about you, Mash?
One thing you
just wrote recently, I tease you, but you're the youngest of us three for sure, but you can probably speak with some authority on this, having done it not so long ago.
And one thing that really helped me in my matric year was just sleeping. Just sleep. Get as much sleep as possible. Because if you are actually straining yourself, and it doesn't apply to everyone, there are people out there who can wake up for 16 hours, study until 3 a.m., be up at 6 a.m. Yeah. I don't know how they do that. I studied with such people. But for me personally, it was just getting the rest I needed. Because having the rest I needed meant that my brain can function at its most maximum capacity. And I was able to actually retain so much more information. So it starts off with taking care of yourself. That's most important in your matric year. Because so many people neglecting their health, just pushing the books. And then when day of writing comes, they're just a mess. They can't even remember anything because they've just pushed themselves to the limit.
Well, you know, here's something. Ancient Ether has got a very specific technique, which is quite interesting. Close your right nostril, breathe through your left. Once you can use the nasal cycle to decrease your body temperature, use your new Apple Watch to check all your metrics. Okay, well,
so you've got all that. She's determining, she's referring to breathe in with your left nostril.
Out with your right.
And breathe out with your left or your right, or alternate.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, literally swapping like that.
Well.
I have seen that.
I mean, I also think that you've got to have some perspective on this because people do put huge amounts of pressure on matrics, and then they go off, they go write them their matric exams, they get their matric, or they don't at the end of it. But I can honestly tell you now, I do not remember a single thing that I wrote in matric. I don't remember one question. I don't remember one answer I gave. And so with the benefit of hindsight, and that's not because I have a terrible memory, which I may have, but like I can remember the lyrics to songs I haven't heard in 20 years. But I do not recall a single thing that I wrote in matric, and that is because it's really important while you're in it, but as soon as you finish with it, you forget about it completely.
Absolutely.
So you got to just have a little bit of perspective here too. So, you know, it's not the end of the world. The worst can happen. Well, you fail, and then you just do it again. Lots and lots of people have. Do you hear about these people who commit suicide? I heard... I think it was Dr. Phil was talking to Joe Rogan, and someone sent me a clip of that. And he was talking about just, you know, how there are these kids who are under so much pressure from their friends and everything else. This girl was in like a hockey team, and she was a really good hockey player, and she was playing with all these other really, really brilliant athletes. And the one girl on the team said something to her, sent her a horrible text or whatever. He said like 5 days from joining this team, she decided to kill herself. And, you know, you think, and we talk about this, we say, oh, well, you know, you've got to have some strength and resilience in you. But this is a new kind of pressure that I don't think we ever really had to deal with. You know, people now, because of phones and everything else, the bullying follows you home. It never stops. It's relentless. It's so many more people because you're on the internet. There are things that we don't, as anybody who isn't currently, you know, in their teens or in their early 20s, you don't understand what these people are going through. And we can say, mm-hmm. well, they've got a much easier life and their life is better. And, you know, it's better to be, you know, growing up now than it was in whatever this, the 90s, the 80s, whenever it was. But actually, there are different pressures now that apply in different ways, and they're just as devastating for those young people as, you know, the kids who were on the milk cartons when we were at school. You know, these kids who'd been.
Yeah. There's also, it's kind of strange to think about, but the more access that we have now to things like Google, Wikipedia, it makes it a little bit more challenging to stick to the syllabus, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. So when we grew up without those things, we studied the syllabus and that was it. We didn't go beyond that.
Yeah.
We might have had a parent who knew a bit more about solar power or whatever, who may have helped us, or history or maths. But as I remember, as soon as my dad introduced a different mathematical method to me than what we had been taught, that would throw me a little bit.
Sure.
And so now having all of this access to absolutely every bit of information you want can sometimes throw you off what the syllabus requires of you.
Yeah.
And the answers that they're looking for, you know what I mean? So you have to kind of try and strike a balance with that as well.
Dogoza says, I remember being super confident in my exam room. I was so ready. The best thing to do for yourself is make sure that you're prepared. Well, that's also what Dr. Hanan said, and good. And Dogozo. By the way, Ancient Ether says, I am a he. So those are the pronouns. That
I'm a he. Sorry for misgendering you.
There we go.
And also, and he also says, no, you need to keep the one nostril closed at all times.
Oh.
So.
All right. Well, you
maybe
know
I was wrong in that too.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, Ancient Ether's advice is quite useful, assuming high school kids have Apple Watches. So.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, Tracy says, primary school suicide is happening more than we want to realize. Yeah, that's terrifying. Yes. You think of these primary school kids. Oy, that scares me. Good Lord. Exam tip from Carl. Keep raisins in your blazer pocket. Raisins are brain food, and chewing stimulates your brain. I chewed them during exams and matric. Useful.
Ooh. I like to eat during exams.
Well, I suppose if you have some raisins in your pocket, what are they going to do? Like chase you out of the exam?
Yeah, no, they can't.
That's not a bad thing. I think you're allowed to do that, aren't you? Surely you can't have your phone with you, obviously, right?
Yeah. You can't.
Did you ever cheat, Leanne? Did you ever write down formulas on the inside of something and then hide them or whatever?
Yes, I did.
Good. Cause I did too.
Read what?
but I wasn't a serial cheater.
Okay.
I reckoned I only used it once or twice in a pinch.
Okay. But where
and you know what else it is sometimes it's that, you know, when you're doing a crossword and the answers are in the back of the book.
Yes.
It's so hard not to look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, that's human nature.
Sure.
And when we used to do those tests where you put your suitcase up in between the two of you, I found it very difficult not to rock back and look at the other person's page. Not because I was trying to be devious, but there's some kind of weird drive within you to see what other people have written.
I remember, Dr.
Hanan could explain.
I wrote a bunch of scientific formulas. There were four of those motion equations that were to do with speed and time and distance.
Mm.
And there were four of them, and I wrote them all down inside, like my, I don't know, a pencil case or something. But luckily no one saw, and I didn't get chased out of the exam, but that was the most cheating I ever did. And I still can't remember those formulas. I mean, like who would remember any of those? Unless you're studying, you know, now.
The worst form of cheating I've ever committed was One of our exams, actually, they didn't detach the answer sheet. So the exams would actually arrive to the school with the answer sheets attached, stapled to them.
Wow.
They had to detach them before they handed them to us. And I don't know how they missed this, but they weren't detached. This was for an Afrikaans exam. And everyone passed it with flying colors.
That's great.
But what actually got us caught, because we were all like signaling to each other in the exam room that detach the answer sheet. So after we're all done, we detached the answer sheet, crumpled them all up, put them in our pockets, handed our papers, and then left. Mm-hmm. But we were all caught out because some dum-dums in the grade, some answers actually had multiple possible answers. Mm-hmm. So people actually wrote like three different answers slashes. And I was like, you dum-dums, you're only supposed to pick one. That's how we all got caught out.
It's always
and everyone got like
stupid.
95% for that. I was like, get some things wrong, y'all.
Yeah, you'd be good at cheating. You can't be like shitty at it. Otherwise, you make it worse for everybody.
Exactly.
That's so irritating.
So we got caught out.
All right, well, let's talk about a couple other things that are in the news today and that you wanted to bring up. So we talk about this, the way kids are dealing with matric exams and all the rest of it. What is this quiet hour thing that's going on, Leanne? Apparently a low sensory, everything's high sensory, everything's about, you know, smell, touch, taste, see, hear. What is this new low sensory shopping experience that everyone's talking about?
So it's actually a Cotton On Kids. We've got Cotton On, the brand that we know, and this is the Cotton On Kids store, big in South Africa. They've introduced something called Quiet Hour into their stores. I mean, if you've ever been in a store, sometimes the music is blaring, the TVs are on, there's a lot of stimulation going on, lots of people. And in a kid's store, especially, the screaming, the crying, it's just a bit much, especially for kids who have like sensory sensitivities.
Yeah.
And can you imagine being a mom of a child who doesn't respond well to these really noisy environments, and having to put them either on a plane or to take them clothes shopping in a store? So yeah, they're being quite woke about it, if you'll excuse that. And they've launched just an hour. In fact, it's only once a week on Thursdays from 3:30 to 4:30. And this is all through October to December during the busy times. And then thereafter, it'll be once a month only. So the music and TVs will be turned off. There'll be a pause on all of the noisy sort of stock work and bringing out of boxes and metal hangers.
So is this especially because of kids who are oversensitive to this stuff? Is that why they're doing it? Or is it something they want to expand into, you know, just give everybody a little bit less like of a stressful, because God knows with all the music and the lights and everything, shopping malls can probably be, even for people who are not, you know, extremely sensitive.
Neurodivergent, yeah. I mean, I am neurodivergent, but still, I know a lot of people who would prefer to shop in an environment like that, even if they aren't highly sensitive to it. And certainly, this is not only for the children, but for the parents as well. And as a parent, I would much rather take my child into that kind of situation if I could, you know. So, yeah, I mean, it might be a lot of people might turn their noses up at it and say that's really a bit much. But it's once a week or once a month for an hour. That there's just a little bit of quiet time. I'm sure the staff appreciate it too, especially in a kid's store.
Yeah. Oh, hell yes.
Yeah,
all that
different
noise.
Different strokes. Yeah, different strokes, Leanne. I mean, I actually do prefer the busyness and the rowdiness of of any shopping mall. I prefer actually having the, like, seeing people going to the changing rooms, people fighting for an outfit, like the last size 32.
I like that
energy that you get from a shopping mall. Just when you're shopping for clothes and there's the music playing, sometimes your favorite song comes on and you're like, oh, let me just shake my ass a little bit in these jeans. So I just love that energy of the shopping mall. And I know it's not for everyone. Some people do need that, that sensory experience and just the peace and quiet of it all. But yeah, I mean, to each their own. And I know that there's kids out there who are hypersensitive to all of this. And for them, I think this is awesome. Awesome stuff for them.
Well, Linda says you just buy your kids a 20 Rand pair of earmuffs from a hardware store and that'll cancel out some of the noise. It works like magic. So, yeah.
Good thinking.
Good point. You can always find a way, Dan. Right? Tracy says should be good for the workers there as well. Imagine working in that kind of environment.
Yeah. Like, it's like working in a nursery school.
So Ancient Ethan and Carl are just asking Leanne, neurodivergent sounds like a superpower, but Carl says Leanne does love a good old ailment, hey? How do you know you're neurodivergent?
I've been diagnosed. I have ADHD.
Do you think you've always had it?
I'm on medication.
Do you think you've always had it?
Yes, I have always had it. It just only became more and more noticeable to me in recent years. But I was diagnosed.
How does it manifest for you?
Like 6 years ago.
What are the things that happen?
It happened. So for me, what exacerbated it was the stress of my mom's stroke when she was in hospital for a year. And, you know, we came close to losing her at that stage. And I was generally battling to find the motivation to work. I was battling to keep to a routine, to a schedule. And we realized and understand that this psychiatrist has treated me for 20 years now for other issues.
Right.
So she was the one who picked up and said, I think this, what's been happening is that you do have ADHD, but this trauma and previous traumas have brought it to light and exacerbated the symptoms.
Well, I mean, listen, that's unfortunate, but at least you're dealing with it, right? You can't ignore these things. And obviously these days, I often think that if we, if we'd had the attention paid to mental health issues that they're paying attention to them now with, when we were kids, we may have ended up with many more diagnoses,
We may have ended up with better performing children.
We might have. Absolutely.
More distinctions and more very successful people in varsity and professors.
Yeah, absolutely. And people might have been taught to deal with things a whole lot better. And maybe we wouldn't have, because obviously, yeah, if you think about it, there are things that our generation has not dealt with particularly well that now become the problem for the next generation, you know, just as the ones before. Yeah. And I think there's also a little bit of like PTSD, you know, from these people who, and I'm not talking about the school or matric exams or anything, because if you get PTSD from that, then you really do need to be on some serious medication. I mean, you're going to have harder challenges in your life than matric exams, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are things, I mean, there are things that, you know, we kind of brush off as being not particularly important, but our lives probably would have been a bit better if we hadn't done things a certain way. When we were at school, I don't know. I don't feel like, you know, my life was either too cushy or too rough. I think like somewhere in between.
Yeah.
But I can only say it for myself because I don't know what it's like to grow up now, and I don't know what it was like to grow up, you know, 50 years before that. So you get your basket of goodies.
Yeah. I mean, we have to remember that you and I were children of the 80s and 90s. And, you know, I was having a family discussion the other evening. We were remembering how ill my brother was. He got tonsillitis, I think 11 times in 1 year. Mm. So basically every month of the year he was ill. And the worst is you can't remove them if the person is infected. Yeah. So this poor kid was just like permanently vomiting and feverish. And, He said to us, why was I not put in hospital? Because it was one particularly bad stint where he hadn't eaten anything for like weeks. And we said, because it was the 80s, you didn't do that then. You got given Panado and sent home.
Right. Well, Mapelo wants to just, on the issue of matric exams, just bring me up to speed. Apparently these days the learners have a formula sheet with all the formulas required attached to the question paper for physics and maths. Okay.
Yes, we did. Yeah, we did have it.
We had to learn them and then, you know. Mm. So if now you get a sheet, then technically I didn't cheat, you know, if they've changed the rules now.
Yeah.
Technically, yeah. I wasn't actually technically. I'm gonna forgive myself that one. Chomotso says, I wish that restaurants would stop blaring music. At some restaurants, you can't even have a decent conversation. Well, that is that's a whole separate issue, but it's something worth discussing. Have you noticed some of these restaurants too? They've now, you know, it's become very cool and trendy to do what I think it must have started in Europe, where you have like DJs or whoever while you're busy eating. That's all good and well. There are a lot of places that are doing this now, but it does make it very loud and very difficult to hear anything. And maybe it's just because we're old and we moan, but you just said yes, Mash, so you obviously agree.
Yes, you guys are not old and moaning. This is an issue that everybody has. And you can't have a freaking conversation at some of these restaurants. I was actually at one of them this past weekend, with 6 hours of no electricity. I had to eat out. But you can't hear the people you're talking to, and you can't even ask them to turn the volume down, because I did ask, our waitress, and she was like, okay, I'll go talk to them.
Nothing.
Talk to them about what? Because nothing happened. Nothing happened. And you can't even hear the person you're talking to. You think to yourself, is this a club or a restaurant? Am I here to eat and talk or to shake my ass and get down?
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of these places become very trendy for them to do this now. They want loud music playing and not necessary. Not necessary.
Or live performances. And then, oh, this person's all up in our food, shaking their hips. And I'm like,
Well, I've got a birthday on Saturday. And the other thing that kind of irritates me is if you go to some restaurants and there are, you know, everybody does their thing for people's birthdays. Some of them make a cake or whatever. But you could have up to 3 or 4 birthdays in a venue. And then it's basically like people singing happy birthday every 5 minutes. It's just as loud. And you're just in the middle of a conversation at a table where there isn't a birthday. But you now have to be roped into all of this because, you know, someone at table number 14 is celebrating.
Yes. Well, these are the prices that we have to pay when we don't have the money for the real price of a private chef or a big entertainment space at home.
Oh, private chef. That sounds
where you
like
can control everything, the music,
Your
air conditioning.
Right, exactly. Bring your body temperature down and you won't get so stressed. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so quickly, because Mash is also going to squeeze this in for us before we get to Markets Mondays. Yes. So, Mash, the different styles of love. Okay, I love that. I love when we talk about this stuff because I don't know who writes these things. Some journo at some like BuzzFeed or whatever comes up with a list, and there's a new list of these things every day. But some of them are fun, and people like to play the game where they which love style do I fall under? So give us the 5 love styles and tell us about these different details and formulae for each of these.
So I got this from, it's not some crappy magazine this time around. I actually got it from, Psych2Go. It's a YouTube channel I'm really into. It's all about mental health.
Okay.
And, this actually also connects back to the conversation we had a bit earlier about growing up in the '80s versus growing up now, with all the stimulants that actually face people, young people, especially going into the metric. So
look at this. Everything's linked. Everything is linked today. This is pretty wild. Good.
Yes. So although we have a choice in becoming the people we strive to be, it is without a doubt that our childhoods shape us to a certain extent. How we choose to react or in different situations and the way we express ourselves are behavioral patterns that are formed starting at a young age. And when we first begin to learn how to make these immediate decisions, it all comes from our immediate environment. Marriage and family counselors Dr. Milan and Kay Yurkovich discovered that everyone has a certain love style based on their upbringing. And these are the 5 love styles.
All right, here we go.
First of all, we have the pleaser. The pleaser often grows up in a home with overly protective or angry, critical parents. As children, pleasers do everything they can to be good and to be on their best behavior so as to not to provoke or get a negative response from their parent. Pleaser children don't receive any comfort. Instead, they spend their time and energy giving comfort to their reactive parent. Pleasers are uncomfortable with conflict and deal with disagreements by often just giving in or making up for them quickly. They usually have a hard time saying no, and because they want to minimize minimalize rather conflict, they may not be truthful and lie to avoid difficult confrontations.
Leanne, you've often said you're a pleaser and you hate conflict. So is this you? Can't hear you. You're on mute.
Absolutely, but it's becoming less and less as I get older and don't really give a bit as much of a shit.
Okay.
That's good. But however, when pleasers do feel stressed or believe that they are continuously letting someone down, they can have a breakdown and flee from relationships. Pleasers often spread themselves thin, trying to be everything to everyone when it's not realistic. And instead of forming healthy boundaries for themselves, they focus more on the needs and desires of others. In order for pleasers to cultivate stable relationships, they have to be honest about their own feelings rather than trying to do what is expected of them.
Okay, well, I'm not a
pleaser. Up next, we have the victim. Pleaser.
The victim? So, okay, tell us about this.
You're not a pleaser. Yeah, you're definitely not a pleaser.
Hell no.
So the victim often grows up in a chaotic home. Victims learn to be compliant in order to survive by putting less attention on themselves so that they can stay under the radar to deal with their angry, violent parents. Victim children learn at a very young age to hide and stay quiet. Because being fully present is painful to them, victim children often build an imaginary world in their heads to cope with dangers they face on a daily basis. Victims have low self-esteem and usually struggle with anxiety and depression. They may end up marrying controllers who mirror the same behaviors as their parents. Victims learn to cope by being adaptable and going with the flow. Because of all the chaos they are used to, victims get uncomfortable in calm situations. They often are always anticipating the next blow up, and this leads them to self-sabotage quite often. So you're not a victim, Gareth, are you?
No. He's definitely not.
No, so
that leaves
me with three. I've got three to choose from, so I'm paying very careful attention.
Let's hope there's one in there for you.
Oh, my God. Otherwise, I think I'm never going to have any love. All right, let's go.
I am definitely the next one. So the next one is the controller. The controller usually grows up in a home where there wasn't a lot of protection, so they learn to toughen up and take care of themselves. They need to feel in control at all times to prevent vulnerability they experienced in their childhood from being exposed in their adulthood. People with this lifestyle believe that they're in control when they can avoid experiencing negative feelings of fear, humiliation, and helplessness. Controllers, however, don't associate anger as vulnerability. They use it as a weapon to remain in power. Controllers have rigid tendencies, but may also be sporadic and unpredictable. They don't like stepping out of their comfort zones because it makes them feel weak and unprotected. They prefer to solve problems on their own and like getting things done in a certain manner. Otherwise, they get angry. People with this lifestyle need to learn to let go. That is me.
Maybe,
is that you, Gary?
But we still got two more, so I'm not going to commit fully to this one yet. Okay, so far we know. All right, so we've got the victim, we've got what was the other one?
Pleaser.
We have the victim, the pleaser, and the controller.
All right, next.
And then the fourth one is the avoider. The avoider often grows up in a less affectionate home that values independence and self-reliance. As children, avoiders learn to take care of themselves starting at a very young age and put their feelings and needs on hold to deal with their anxieties of the anxieties of having little to no comfort from their parents. Avoiders tend to like their space and rely on logic and detachment more than their emotions. They get uncomfortable when people around them experience intense mood swings. In order for avoiders to cultivate healthy, long-lasting relationships, they need to learn how to open up and express their emotions honestly.
Okay.
So, yep. And then the last one is the vacillator.
Ooh.
The vacillator often grows up with an unpredictable parent. Vacillators learned that their needs aren't their parents' top priority. Without consistent affection from their parents, vacillators develop a deep fear of abandonment. But when the parent finally feels like giving them the time and attention, vacillators are usually too angry and tired to receive it. as vacillators enter adulthood, they try to find the consistent love they were deprived of as children. Vacillators have a tendency to idealize new relationships, but once they feel let down or disappointed, they grow dejected and doubtful. They often feel misunderstood and experience a lot of internal conflict, Matt, emotional stress.
I think you wrote this article. I don't think it's written by you. You wrote this, right?
No, I didn't write this. So in order for vacillators to cultivate healthy, stable relationships, they need to learn how to pace themselves and get to know someone before committing too soon and getting hurt by their own expectations. So I hope you guys learned something about yourselves. And we still need to find out which one Gareth is here.
I don't know, but Ancient Ether says, I might be a controller. And Dogozo says, okay, I'm the controller. Sounds like a horrible person.
They all sound horrible or weak or pathetic.
Sanella says, where is the whore in all these options? It needs to be a whore.
Well, if you're a vacillator, you may have tendencies to.
Yeah.
Yes, the vacillator is a whore one week. Yeah, vacillators are most likely to be whores. So each one does have their positives. They're not all just negative. I mean, the victims tend to actually be very affectionate. But of course, because of their chaotic background, they do self-sabotage a lot. So each one has some positive aspects to them. Some have some more negative than positive, like the controller. But when things are good, they're great. When things are bad, they're bad. So there is no in between. There's some positives with each. So I'm the controller. Leanne, you said you're the victim.
No, I'm a combination of one and two.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I would say, Gareth, you're a combination between three and four.
That is what? The controller and the avoider.
And the vacillator. Yes, the avoider and the vacillator.
How about the person who does not give a fuck about what can't be? That's probably
the avoider.
You think I'm avoiding?
I just think this
is the kind of navel gazing that you know, it's become very popular in all of these like pseudo psychology, you know, articles and memes that are floating around on the internet. I just think it's probably not that exciting. And everybody thinks they have some love language, love style, but you might actually just be really shitty at love. Maybe that's also true for some people. I mean, I'm not saying it's true for me.
You could just be a whore.
But you could also just be a whore. Yeah, you could be. Some people are really good at love. Some people are really bad at it. Some people are working on it all the time. Some people have a long way to go. I got the funniest voice note yesterday. You know, sometimes people leave voice notes on the studio line, and Ryan sent me one from somebody who is in love with me, and she basically poured her heart out, and she wrote me a poem. Now, I'm not going to embarrass her because it's really funny and actually kind of silly, but I'm not going to embarrass her by playing it because someone might recognize her voice and then she gets teased or whatever at work, and that's not fair. But she wrote this this poem, which is awful, and also, this is the difference between people. It's like some people would respond very well to a poem. It might get them more interested. But when I hear the word poem, it disengages me even more. Like if you tell me you've written
the avoider.
If someone said to me,
you know what?
If someone said to me, I've written you a poem, it's the worst.
When somebody writes you a song or writes you a poem, it's always awkward unless they are award-winning poets or musicians, then that's okay. But the rest of the time, it's awkward.
Just stay away from poetry. It's not, you know, it really isn't. It's just the worst thing.
Yeah.
When someone says, I want to show you my poem. Can I share my poem with you? That is creepy. Exactly the opposite of what most of us want to hear.
Mm. Unless you're like Lord Byron or...
Yeah, of course.
I don't know. Some
or like
singer.
Beyonce or Lady Gaga or something. Yeah. I've talked to someone who used to like sending me voice notes singing. Oh, those are so cringe. And I'll be like, wow, beautiful, baby. Oh, so beautiful. But I'm so grossed out. I'm like, oh, Jesus. I've listened to another damn 2-minute voice note of this person just... Ugh. no, the horrible gross. Singing.
It is. And so, you know what? Just, mm-hmm. Yeah. Some people are too sure of themselves, and some people have no confidence at all in love. So you find your own lane and you stick to it. And you know what? You might just be, like we've said a few times now, you might just be a whore. So you could also deal with that. All right.
An avoider.
From the ridiculous to the sublime. And this is our chance now to catch up on a Monday morning with what's going on in the markets. And just in case you don't already know what we do every couple of Mondays, is we have a feature effectively where we talk about what's going on in the markets. And we'll be having an in-depth discussion today around the state of the global environment, economic trends, what is moving the markets, all the really, really useful information. And we've got someone here who knows all of that stuff. So we've got some very particular things we want to address with Neil Wilson, who we'll be talking to in a moment. He's a chief market analyst at markets.com and at Finalto. And he will provide us with some expert analysis of market movements and the macroeconomic trends. Very, very important stuff. We're going to get to that in a second. But whether you're a new trader who's looking for a safe place to start, or you're an experienced trader who's looking for low spreads, multi-assets, and high tech, you will find markets.com suits you perfectly. A special offer to everybody who is listening now, if you haven't already tried this, you can follow the links on cliffcentral.com to register with markets.com. Just go to the website and you can find all the links there. You will get a 30% bonus on your deposit. Now, that is really big. That's a big deal. That's an extra injection of cash that you wouldn't have had otherwise. And if you refer a friend, you will both get a 30% bonus. So make sure you click the link on Markets Mondays on cliffcentral.com for more information. Get in there ASAP. You refer a friend, you will both get a 30% bonus. That sounds like a good reason to get involved, if you ask me. So let's welcome Neil Wilson and bring him on. Hey, Neil, how are you?
Hi. Good morning. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah.
Good.
Everyone over there.
Yeah, great to see you again. Neil, I gave a little bit of an introduction where I said that we would be looking today at the state of the global environment. Obviously, it's election week in the United States, and we know that politics tends to cause some upstream effects, which downstream make the economy behave a little more erratically at times like these. But what are we looking at? And in particular, let's begin by talking about the Fed. What has happened with the fallout from the Fed's decision on interest rates just last week?
Yeah, so I mean, it was quite a big week for the market with the Fed raising interest rates again by 0.75%. So another jumbo-sized rate hike. That's the fourth in a row. Really, sort of hammering home the fact that they're trying to, you know, get on top of the inflation dragging, if you like, and it's, they're trying to get control of it, but struggling still. The Fed raised rates. The fallout initially, you know, we sort of saw the market kind of not quite sure whether it was hawkish, i.e., you know, pushing for tighter financial conditions, and you know, more tight than the market has thought anyway, or dovish, which is looser financial conditions. Mm-hmm. And then you had this press conference with the President Jay Powell, and then it kind of all fell out. And there was quite a lot of volatility last week. I think that was really the key thing. So we saw stocks really taking a hit from that Fed meeting. But then into the end of the week, we had the monthly US labor market report, the non-farm payrolls report. That's always closely watched for being a leading indicator of what the Fed might do next. And we saw unemployment tick up in the US. And so that was just seen by the market maybe as a bit more positive, although it's higher unemployment should be positive, but it's all this sort of funny dynamic whereby if there's bad economic data, then you think, well, the Fed's not going to do so much. Therefore, that's actually quite good for stock markets. So we saw a lot of push and pull on that front. And I think the market's still trying to make up its mind about how far the Federal Reserve needs to go in raising interest rates. And then that has global ramifications, because really where the Fed goes, the rest of the world is kind of following. And the key thing really from last week was just that level of volatility that still exists, because we don't know where interest rates are going to end up.
in the near future. You mentioned the downstream effects of this on the world economy and on markets like South Africa. So is there any impact on this, on the South African markets as a result of this Fed decision?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you just look at the sort of the price action, you know, just what was going on in the South African market, certainly, you know, if you look at it in the wake of the meeting and in the wake of the non-farms as well, you know, you saw a lot of movement. You saw the Rand rallying on Friday. You saw the SA 40 index, the leading 40 companies that rallied well. You know, so in relation to the non-farms as well as the Fed, the two are all sort of interconnected, just, you know, giving a sort of macro kind of picture. And you saw that South African index rally. But with South Africa, I think it's worth noting, you know, there's the Fed certainly is driving a lot of this because of, the global ramifications from interest rates and the dollar. The strong dollar is a key thing here. But also, I think this sort of chatter, rumors around China reopening and easing the pressure in global supply chains, that is driving a lot as well, particularly in some of the basic resources stocks and the miners, and that's obviously quite a key component of the South African index. So there's a couple of big global macro trends that are buffeting the South African financial markets right now. Mm-hmm. I think we've got a webinar actually coming up this week with Simon Brown, so that he's going to be discussing a bit more about that in depth later this week. So there's a lot happening out there.
That is useful to know, and we're also familiar with Simon, so we will we'll be telling people about that presentation of his as well, once we have some more info on it. I wanted to ask you, though, with the Fed and interest rates, I mean, a lot of people complaining it's not enough and that they need to raise them significantly and over a prolonged period. What is your feeling on this? Do you think that the Fed has more plans to keep raising interest rates? And at what level will interest rates be able to bring inflation under control?
Yeah, so the market right now is kind of thinking around that sort of 5% level. We're at 4% now with the Fed funds rate. The market thinks maybe 5%. What the Fed did last week was say we think it's going to be a bit higher than we previously thought, so it's moved up to above 5% in terms of that pricing, that market futures pricing. The problem is that once inflation gets above 5%, that it's never been brought down to target, so back down to 2% level inflation, more kind of comfortable level of inflation, without the interest rate going above the inflation rate. So it currently sits around sort of 8%. There's different measures, but say it sits around 8%. So you think maybe that the Fed has, although the Fed thinks it's going to move, the Fed sort of thinks, well, we're going to move up to five and a bit and then stop. And that will bring it down eventually over time. The problem is that maybe it just needs to keep going, and that's maybe what the market's missing out on right now.
Well, I mean, didn't that happen with Paul Volcker back in the 80s as well? He kept raising and raising and raising the interest rates, and people thought, oh, this is going to devastate the economy, but it did eventually bring inflation under control, and it did launch a very good bullish season for the U.S. for some 10, 12 years after that. Once everything had been rationalized, because all the market's trying to do, and correct me where I'm wrong here, Neil, because you're the expert, is find some kind of equilibrium, some sort of balance. And, you know, it's all supply and demand, and there's a lot of money that's been injected into the markets at the moment, which is what's causing the inflation. And what's going to happen with interest is that obviously the money will find the place where it's most desired. And hopefully this will be controlled by things like the interest rates at the Fed.
Yeah, I mean, that's it, exactly. It's a very good way of describing it. And I think that the key uncertainty, the key unknown right now is when does inflation, how, at what level does inflation come down? And I think the problem for the market and the problem for the Fed and everyone is that once inflation becomes unleashed, it's really, really difficult to bring it back down.
Right.
And the analogy is the toothpaste analogy. You can squeeze it out, but it's very difficult to shove it back in. But that's uncertain. So the uncertain thing for the market right now is the ultimate level of interest rates. So the terminal rate, it's called. So where the Fed and other central banks eventually top out I think that's the big unknown. And that's really why stock markets are still very volatile. We're still in this bear market, although we're seeing these bear market rallies where we get a push up on sort of hope that things have maybe stabilized. But, you know, until the Fed actually stops, that's really the point at which we can get some more certainty, and therefore investors can feel confident again to start putting their money to work.
All right. Last bit of information with regard to the politicians is obviously we mentioned the midterm elections, which are happening this week, Tuesday, tomorrow. So is there anything there that we need to look out for? How will the markets respond if A, it goes very heavily towards the Republicans, as the polls are telling us it will, or B, if in fact the polls are wrong and it ends up putting a whole lot of Democrats back into office, both in gubernatorial elections, in the Senate elections, and then for members of the House of Representatives? How will that affect the economy and the markets in general?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Democrat clean sweep, it's quite low tail risk, if you like, if you call it that. The chances of that happening are quite small. I think that the Republicans seem to be set to take the House of Representatives. That looks pretty sure. Less clear in the Senate exactly what happens, but I think, you know, if you get that Democrat clean sweep, low chances of it happening. If it does happen, then Biden can push on with some of his agenda a lot more easily, and that could, well, we think that might be inflationary, so that might add to more stimulus, more fiscal support, and that could actually worsen inflation, which pushed the Fed to do more, and therefore probably bad for the market. Republicans clean sweep would be probably net positive for the market, just because some of that agenda that Joe Biden wants to push through is less likely to be delivered. The chances are probably that the market rallies anyway after the election over the next few months. We've had quite a significant drawdown over the last this year, and traditionally, usually, since the war, I think 17 out of 19 midterm elections, you've actually seen the market do a lot better in the 6 months after the elections than in the 6 months before. So once you remove the uncertainty of the election and you get the clarity about what the situation is in Washington, investors start to tend, you know, historically to pile back in. So you think that unless the Democrats can surprise with by taking both houses, then I think probably that's what happens.
All right. One last thing then. We've paid attention to the US, but the UK, I mean, with all their political shenanigans in the last while, has hardly been a picture of stability themselves. Let's just look at the Bank of England, because they've also hiked their rates. Is the turbulence in the UK over?
Yeah, well, we'd like to think so, but you never know. There does seem to be a lot more political stability with the new Prime Minister and Chancellor, and we get a bit more on that on November the 17th with the autumn statement, the budget. So that's going to be more pain, I think, for consumers, and ultimately the financial markets are not. You know, they're not worried too much about what consumer pain there is. Unfortunately, they work on other things, and think the volatility in the UK is now predominantly just a global phenomenon. I don't think, you know, after the mini budget back in September and all that stramash about that, there was a real UK premium, a sort of political risk premium, or what one analyst called the moron risk premium, that was added to the cost of UK debt. It was an extra cost to our debt because they just weren't sure what we were going to do, because the political situation and the fiscal policy seemed all over the place.
Right.
That's sort of worked itself out, and I think we're back to square one with that. But the global situation is still quite uncertain. I think, and the UK is quite an open global economy in that sense, and our markets are very diverse, and we're much at the mercy of what's going on globally, but I think, you know, internally, at least domestically, I think things have settled down somewhat.
I hope, from your mouth to God's ears, and I hope we have a very good week, and there are some nice takeaways from all these these new developments, obviously the elections, the UK system settling down. Are there any other things on the horizon that we need to be on the lookout for at the moment? I mean, there's always some geopolitical threat. What are you looking at?
Well, I think one of there's probably, as I said before, the China, whether China reopens, that's a big one, because that's going to play into what, you know, what the third term of Xi Jinping actually means. You know, is he seeking to create a new direction? Obviously, the Taiwan situation is something that, that could happen at any point. And I think that's probably the biggest sort of black swan, or it's not really a black swan because we kind of know it might happen. But if it did happen, it would still be like a thunderbolt and be hugely disruptive to the market.
Sure.
But also, I think just looking to see what happens with Italy and the new prime minister. She's just finding her feet and kind of building that government, and just looking to see what sort of friction there might be between Italy and Brussels, and that could potentially lead to some volatility and maybe some widening of bond spreads in Europe, and that could create some volatility for the euro as well. So there's a few things, and there's always going to be something out there, so we're just sort of keeping our eyes open.
All right, Neil, thank you so much. Neil Wilson from markets.com and Finalto. He is the chief market analyst for them, and we have the benefit of his wisdom this morning and his experience too in the market. So thank you, Neil. Have a great week.
Cheers.
Cheers. Bye-bye. So Neil Wilson and markets.com. And just in case you haven't already started, you need to get into Markets Mondays, brought to you by markets.com. They'll be back again in a few weeks' time. Remember to follow the link on cliffcentral.com to register with them. You'll get a 30% bonus, and you can get that on top of your deposit. If you also refer a friend, you will both get a 30% bonus. Make sure that you click on the links on Markets Mondays on cliffcentral.com so you can get all of the benefits of that. Mash and Leanne, have a happy Monday.
Thanks.
Have
you
a good
too.
One, guys.
Enjoy your week.
Cool, everybody. Enjoy. Cheers. We'll see you tomorrow, 6 a.m. Don't miss it. Bye-bye.
Cliffcentral.com.